Becoming a Catholic broadens the mind. It especially broadens the mind about the reasons for becoming a Catholic. Standing in the center where all roads meet, a man can look down each of the roads in turn and realize that they come from all points of the heavens.
When G.K. Chesterton was asked why he became a Catholic, his short answer was, to get rid of my sins. For the longer answer, he wrote a book, and that book was The Catholic Church and Conversion. Hello, I'm Dale Ahlquist, and welcome to The Apostle of Common Sense, a series of programs where we explore the words and wisdom of the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton was received into the Catholic Church in 1922 at the age of 48, after what was a very long and steady and deliberate conversion. Though he had already written eloquently and even forcefully in defense of the Catholic faith, and though he had even written a famous book of mystery stories featuring an amateur detective who was a Roman Catholic priest, Chesterton waited a long time before becoming Catholic himself. He tells part of the story in The Catholic Church and Conversion, which he wrote in 1927, 5 years after he joined the church. But before we discuss the book, there are two things we should mention about that day in 1922 when G.K. Chesterton was received into the Catholic Church. First of all, that famous detective, Father Brown, was based on a real priest whom Chesterton had befriended many years before. His name was Father John O'Connor. When Chesterton informed Father O'Connor of his decision, the priest gave him a copy of the Penny Catechism to read. And on the morning he was to be received into the church, Chesterton was seen reading it. Afterwards, he said that when he read it, he was struck by an expression that seemed exactly to sum up something he'd been trying to express all his life. It was the statement that the two sins against hope are presumption and despair. He said, "The heresies that have attacked human happiness in my time have all been variations either of presumption or of despair." And after receiving his first communion that Sunday morning, Chesterton wrote a poem called The Convert, which is probably his most personal statement about his conversion.
After one moment when I bowed my head, and the whole world turned over and came upright, and I came out where the old road shone white, I walked the ways and heard what all men said. Forests of tongues like autumn leaves unshed, being not unlovable, but strange and light. Old riddles and new creeds, not in despite, but softly, as men smile about the dead. The sages have 100 maps to give, that trace their crawling cosmos like a tree. They rattle reason out through many a sieve, it stores the dust, then lets the gold go free. And all these things are less than dust to me, because my name is Lazarus, and I live.
In the book, The Catholic Church and Conversion, Chesterton says that although all roads lead to Rome, each pilgrim is tempted to talk as if all roads had been like his own road. But the church is a house with 100 gates, and no two men enter at exactly the same angle. Still, while every conversion story is different, every conversion story is also the same. Chesterton recognizes that there are three stages which most every convert goes through on his road to Rome. The first stage is patronizing the church. The second is discovering the church. And the third is running away from the church. It may surprise some to know that Chesterton was raised as a Unitarian Universalist. When he first embraced Christianity, as described in his book Orthodoxy, he had a very orthodox view of it. He joined the Church of England, which he says was simply his own uncompleted conversion to Catholicism. But since he was never really a Protestant, he never held any of the Protestant views towards Rome. That is to say, he was never really anti-Catholic. he did not have to deal with some of the same stumbling blocks that many Protestant converts have to overcome on their way to Rome. The two main objections regard the Bible and the priesthood. Chesterton deals rather handily with these. In the first place, he says, Protestants are simply misinformed about what the Catholic view towards Scripture is. The usual protest of the Protestant is that the Church of Rome is afraid of the Bible. There are a couple of ironic things about this. First of all, says Chesterton, I grew up in a world in which the Protestants, who had just proved that Rome did not believe in the Bible, were excitingly discovering that they did not believe in the Bible themselves. And secondly, he says, perhaps he could understand an outsider dismissing the church altogether, saying its scrolls, its statues, its rituals and candles were all bosh, but he could not understand an outsider dismissing everything about the church except the scrolls, and to put faith only in the scrolls, and to claim that the scrolls, which came from the church, were against the church. On the subject of priests, Chesterton responds to the Protestant accusations that priests are dangerous and unnatural and unholy men by saying, here Protestants want to have it both ways. They think a priest is a fool for keeping his vows and a scoundrel for breaking them. He says, why should a man who wanted to be wicked encumber himself with special and elaborate promises to be good? Chesterton dismisses these and the other Protestant pictures of Catholicism as obvious blunders. The real reasons which prevent people from becoming Catholic are not the lies about the Catholic Church, but rather the truth about it. There is a fear not of the vices of the Church, but of its virtues. For example, the fear of the confessional. A religion which has as one of its foundations, the confessing of sins, is a religion that deals in truth. The fear, of course, is unfounded, for the penitent finds that the confessional is a place of mercy and gigantic generosity. Still, a very real fear remains of the church's reality. This is a church, says Chesterton, that tells us clearly who we are responsible to and what we are responsible for. The rest of the world finds such clarity not just uncomfortable, but frightening. That fear is what the convert faces at the third stage of conversion, which is running away from the church. That fear can be most intense when we know the facts rather than the falsehoods, when we know that the last step is entirely up to us. But before discussing this final step, let's briefly return to the first two stages of conversion, patronizing the church and discovering the church. The convert takes his first step rather unwittingly when he decides he's going to be fair to the Catholic Church. He does not think the Roman religion is true, but for the first time, he doesn't think that the accusations against the church are true. This important first step leads to a long and enjoyable second step, which is the utter fascination of learning what the Catholic Church really does teach. Chesterton says that this is the most pleasant part of the business, easier than joining the Catholic Church and much easier than trying to live the Catholic life. It is like discovering a new continent full of strange flowers and fantastic animals, which is at once wild and hospitable. But then the convert suddenly realizes with a shock that he can no longer be detached and impartial about the Catholic Church.
It is impossible to be just to the Catholic Church. The moment a man ceases to pull against it, he feels a tug towards it. The moment he ceases to shout it down, he begins to listen to it with pleasure. The moment he tries to be fair to it, he begins to be fond of it. But when that affection has passed a certain point, it begins to take on the tragic and menacing grandeur of a, of a great love affair. The man has exactly the same sense of having committed or compromised himself, of having been, in a sense, entrapped, even if he is glad to be entrapped. But for a considerable time, he's not so much glad as simply terrified. It may be that this real psychological experience has been responsible for all that remains of the legend that Rome is a mere trap. But you see, that legend misses the whole point of the psychology. It is not the Pope who has set the trap, or the priests who have baited it. The whole point of the position is that the trap is simply the truth. The whole point is that the man himself has made his way towards the trap of truth, and not that the trap has run after the man.
We have said that Chesterton's conversion was gradual and deliberate, but as any convert knows, that last step is still a huge one. He says the space between doing and not doing such a thing is so tiny and so vast. It's one thing to conclude that Catholicism is good, and another to conclude that it is right. It's one thing to conclude that it is right, and another to conclude that it is always right. It is indeed stepping out of one world and into another, and that's no small step. There is one more rather surprising thing that can prevent that final step. As a convert myself, I can attest to the truth of what Chesterton means when he says, "There is many a convert who has reached a stage at which no word from any Protestant or pagan could any longer hold him back. Only the word of a Catholic can keep him from Catholicism. One foolish word from inside does more harm than 100,000 foolish words from outside." Catholics sometimes do a very poor job of presenting their faith, saying or doing or emphasizing the wrong thing, showing no appreciation or understanding either of the convert or of the faith. They are often more effective at keeping people away from the faith than its enemies are, because, as Chesterton says, its enemies aren't really very effective at all. When the convert finally does overcome all the obstacles of his own fear and ignorance, when he finally does take the final step, well, to put it mildly, that's when things really get interesting. First of all, there are the curious reactions of other people who, for some reason, think that the convert finding peace of mind means that his mind has stopped working.
To become a Catholic is not to leave off thinking, but to learn how to think. It is so in exactly the same sense in which to recover from palsy is not to leave off moving, but to learn how to move. The Catholic convert has for the first time found a starting point for straight and strenuous thinking. He has for the first time a way of testing the truth in any question that he raises. As the world goes, especially at present, it is the other people, the heathen and the heretics, who seem to have every virtue except the power of connected thought. What is now called free thought is valued, not because it is free thought, but because it is freedom from thought, because it is free thoughtlessness. The outsiders stand by and see, or think they see, the convert entering with bowed head a sort of small temple, which they are convinced is fitted up inside like a prison, if not a torture chamber. But all they really know about it is that he has passed through a door. They do not know that he has not gone into the inner darkness, but out into the broad daylight. And the convert discovers only when he has finally entered the church that the church is much larger on the inside than on the outside.
Chesterton says, "The Catholic Church is the only thing which saves a man from the degrading slavery of being a child of his age." Every age seems bent on trying to create a new religion. But new religions are only suited to what is new. They express one idea at a time because that idea happens to be fashionable at the moment. They profess to be progressive because the boast of their period is progress. They claim to be democratic because our political system claims to be democratic. They boast of reconciliation with science, which is often only a premature surrender to science. They get rid of everything that may look or seem old-fashioned. They claim to have bright services and cheery sermons. The churches compete with the cinemas. The churches even become the cinemas. But religions that are based on moods and fashions are not really religions at all. And of course, because they are based on moods and fashions, they cannot last. The Catholic Church, says Chesterton, has all the freshness of a new religion, but it also has the richness of an old religion. It does not change with people's taste. It is a religion that binds men to their morality even when they are not in the mood to be moral. The Church often has to go against the grain of the world. It has preached social reconciliation to fierce and raging factions who would much rather destroy each other. He says it has preached charity to the old pagans who did not believe in it, just as it now preaches chastity to the new pagans who do not believe in it.
We do not need a religion that is right when we are right. What we need is a religion that is right when we are wrong. Some people merely take the modern mood and then require their creed to be cut down to fit that mood. But you see, the mood would exist even without the creed. They say they want a religion to be social, when they would be social without any religion. They say they want a religion to be practical, when they would be practical without any religion. They say they want a religion acceptable to science, when they would accept the science even if they did not accept the religion. They say they want a religion like this because they are like this already. They say they want it, when what they really mean is that they could do without it.
People, of course, don't like to be told that there are certain things which they can't do. They think that means they don't have liberty. But Chesterton already showed in the book Orthodoxy that freedom is something that exists only within the rules. It is when you break the rules that you become bound by the consequences. Chesterton finds this idea confirmed in the Catholic Church. He finds it a place of enormous liberty. The vetoes are actually very few, but they are very clear, and they have only our ultimate interest in mind. We are obsessed with the forbidden fruit. But Chesterton says, there's actually something fruitful about the forbidden fruit, in the sense of a fascinating botanical study of why it is really poisonous, and why the Church is right to forbid it. He says that the Church's rules are merely common sense.
The Church is right in the main, in being tolerant in the main. But it is where she is intolerant that she is most right, and even more reasonable. Adam lived in a garden where 1,000 mercies were granted to him. But the one prohibition was the greatest mercy of all.
Chesterton finds that the Church has been true all along, true to the first and the last things, true to our unspoiled instincts and our conclusive experience. It did not surrender to fashion nor to intellectual snobs. Because it has not surrendered, the Church has the reputation for being behind the times. In truth, it is usually ahead of the times. For instance, Chesterton found that his own ideas about economic and social justice, which he came upon very slowly, had already been articulated by Pope Leo XIII decades before him. Pope Leo said, as many as possible of the working classes should become owners. What Chesterton thought was a new and urgent idea was already the position of the Catholic Church. It's worth repeating. The Catholic Church is the only thing which saves a man from the degrading slavery of being a child of his age. Slavery. To associate the Church with freedom and every other religion and philosophy with slavery is startling and a striking idea. But Chesterton does not make the statement merely for its shock effect. He speaks from his own experience. In the Church he found freedom. The truth does set you free. He says if he ever left the Church, it would mean giving up his freedom.
I could no more go back to those cushioned chapels than a man who has regained his sanity would willingly go back to his padded cell. I know that Catholicism is too large for me, and I have not yet explored all its beautiful and terrible truths. But I know that Universalism and every other Protestant sect is too small for me, and I could not creep back into that dull safety now that I have looked on the dizzy vision of liberty.
Chesterton ends the book with an interesting postscript. He notes that there are quite a few conversions at the time. He does not know the statistics, but he says statistics are misleading anyway. The point is, he was a convert and he knew of many others. He knew of the reality of conversion. At the same time, he notes that a number of people were leaving the church. He notes that the reason they were leaving was not because of the church's creed, but because of its moral restraints. But Chesterton says that he actually has more sympathy with the person who leaves the church for a love affair than with one who leaves it for a long-winded German theory to prove that God is evil or that children are a sort of morbid monkey. In other words, it's not a controversy between two defined philosophies, but as he says, a controversy between philosophers and philanderers. As such, he was not worried about the outcome of the battle between those who have stayed and those who have scattered. There will always be people who quarrel with the church's moral teaching. Chesterton might be surprised to know that today they don't want to leave the church, they want to stay and try to change the teaching to accommodate their own bad ideas or bad morals. And yet, Chesterton ends the book with a prophetic comment that is both troubling and hopeful at the same time. He says, at worst, there will be a battle between bad Catholics and good Catholics with the great dome over all. I'm Dale Ahlquist. Join us again on The Apostle of Common Sense.